Get ready for the smartest bundle in streaming. 6 streaming services for the intellectually curious. Featuring Curiosity Stream with the best collection of documentary films and TV shows. Psalm TV and great stories from the world of wine. Taste Made for the fun side of food and travel. Topic with the best thrillers and crime stories. And so much more. From nature to history, technology to food, mystery to adventure. Get 6 streaming services for one low price and less than $6 a month. It's the best deal in streaming. Learn more and sign up now at smartbundle.com.
No, Josh, I'm sick and tired of this. We're through, my girlfriend Christina said to me. I would have been a fool not to have seen this coming. Yet here I was, stunned that she had actually pulled the trigger. Our relationship had been rocky, to say the least, full of fights, arguments, heartbreak, and hate. Not hate for each other, no, we loved each other. Hate that we couldn't make this work. A typical Friday night consisted of us screaming at each other over the most insignificant things, getting into a fight over something the average couple wouldn't have blinked an eye about. Yet I still loved her, and would give anything for her. Oh, what do you mean we're through? I eventually managed to mutter out, feeling hot tears already forming in my eyes. I mean, I can't want to be with you any longer, Josh. I'm breaking up with you, she said as she took off her ring and lay it in my hand. The rest of the night was a blur. I managed to somehow drive back to my place through teary eyes and found myself sitting on the edge of my bed, my mind in agony and my hands running over the metal apparatus I held. Normally, I was a very rational guy, being a straight-A student at one of the most prestigious universities in my state. Yet, as I sat there, staring at the 9mm pistol, I rolled back and forth through my hands. All I wanted to do was make her sorry. I sent my parents a goodbye text, one they wouldn't read until they woke up in the morning, walked outside to my car, stepped inside, turned on the ignition one last time, and drove to our spot. We had both loved to hike, having first met on a trail that overlooked the vast skyline of our city, when her dog tried taking a bite out of the granola bar I had stopped to eat. 2 years later, I had asked her to marry me on the same rock I climbed, trying to evade what I thought was a vicious German shepherd trying to attack me. She said yes. That was a year ago, and all I could think about on my drive was how happy we had been then. I parked the car and brandished the gun my father had given me on my 22nd birthday. He had done this so I would have a means of self-protection, as I was moving across the state to attend college. I realized how ironic this was when I stepped out of my car and made my way up the trails to the peak where I had met the girl I thought I would be spending the rest of my life with. I let out a pain-stricken chuckle as I realized I was technically right. When I reached our spot, I sat on the rock and looked over the city, starting to reconsider what I was about to do. I then reached into my pocket and turned on my phone, intending to check the time. Instead, I was greeted by my lock screen, a picture of Christina kissing my cheek, staring back at me. With newly formed tears rolling down my cheeks, I took the single bullet I had brought with me and loaded the gun. As I pulled the hammer back, I couldn't help but notice how beautiful the city's lights were reflecting off the barrel. I put the muzzle to my temple, choked out, "I love you, Christina," through sobs, and pulled the trigger. Everybody expects something different out of death. Some think your life is going to flash before your eyes. Others imagine a reunion with all their deceased family members. Others picture being reincarnated as an animal. I had been an atheist, imagining death similar to falling asleep and never waking up. You can imagine my surprise when I opened my eyes and found myself lying on a bed of red gravel. Thinking I hadn't successfully killed myself, I quickly felt for any sort of wound on my head, but I only felt my own hair and skin. Realizing I wasn't staring at a blood-soaked ground, I slowly pushed myself up to my knees and took in my surroundings. "Hey there, sport." I jumped, quickly turning around to see a tall, thin man in a dark maroon suit, with a face as pale as the moon and dark red hair slicked back to his shoulders. He was standing about 4 feet behind me, hands behind his back, and a look of excitement strewn across his face.
Who are you? Where am I?"
I managed to stutter, my mind still racing as to where I was and why I was not dead. The man revealed a cane with a polished ruby serving as the handle and exclaimed, "Oh, now, that wouldn't be right of me now, would it? Taking all the fun out of guessing? Look around you and tell me where you think you might be." He stretched his arms out, pointing the cane at the environment around us. I turned my head to look, gazing at the hellish scene before me as fear started to take hold. I now noticed more than just the lava and people. I noticed dark cracks in the earth below us that seemed to extend into an infinite abyss, screaming coming from some of the people in the distance. Screaming that should have long ruptured your vocal cords. A look of anguish on the face of every person I saw. How uncomfortably hot the place was. "Hell," I muttered, without even knowing, starting to feel an uncontrollable sense of panic overtake me.
"Bingo!"
shouted the man, smiling, revealing pearly white teeth.
I'm in hell," I said, standing to face the man.
"Well, yes and no," started the man. "Hell is probably the best word for it, but it's not like the hell you read about in the Bible or whatever book your parents used to read to you to keep you from having sex too young or whatever's taboo nowadays. No, this place is more of a, well, personal hell." The man put both of his hands on his cane and stared out into the distance. "You see, a hell isn't the best word for this place because that would imply that there exists a heaven, which, unfortunately for your kind, there does not. No, this place is more of an afterlife, where every wicked man, woman, and child end up to pay for their, well, I guess you would call them sins." The man turned to face me, his smile now wider than before. "And you, my dear boy, you've got quite a doozy of a sin. The way this place was set up by the master architect himself, I guess you would call him the devil, is that the temperature around you starts to rise until you've carried out a representation of the sin you committed during your life on Earth. Afterwards, you wake up somewhere else and the heat starts to increase until you do so again. An infinite cycle, if you will," the man said as he walked to the other side of me. "A few examples to help you better understand what I mean. A prideful man might have to be trampled under the feet of others. A whore might have to be raped again and again. A glutton might have to stuff himself until his stomach bursts. I could go on, but your face shows that you get the idea. And you decided to perform brain surgery on himself with a bullet. So you get to commit suicide for all eternity. Now, doesn't that sound like fun?" I became so nauseous I vomited, refusing to believe that this was real. I looked up at him, sputtering. "Are you Satan?"
"Satan?
No, my name's Zave. I'm just a helper to the devil. A one-man welcome party, if you will." As he was laughing, the temperature seemed to have risen a few degrees, sweat now dripping from my hair. "Well, it appears as though it has already started for you. So I'll leave you to it." I rubbed my eyes, trying to get the stinging sweat out of them, and when I looked up, the man was gone. I couldn't believe what he had said. I thought to myself that this had to be a dream, but I was proven wrong when the temperature continued to rise and started singeing the hairs on my skin. Desperately trying to think of a way to end this, I recalled what the man had said, that I needed to kill myself or this God-forbidden place would get hotter and hotter, increasing infinitely and causing an amount of pain that could only exist in hell. Not knowing what else to do, and hoping I would wake up from this nightmare, I ran towards a cliff on the side of the rocky terrain I was on and hurled myself off, hoping to end the suffering.
Not a second after my head struck the surface below, I opened my eyes to find myself in a new area of this tormenting place. The same cycle continued more times than I can remember. I would wake up somewhere else in hell, search around while the temperature was bearable, and find a way to kill myself when the heat became burning. I've killed myself in more ways than I thought possible, as not everywhere I appeared had a readily available cliff to jump from. I've shoved sand down my throat until I choked to death. I've impaled myself on numerous tree branches. I've inhaled sulfur until it scalds my lungs, and I drown on my own fluid. I even ripped out my own throat when I couldn't find any other means. After the heat became so great, my skin started bubbling. While the temperature always rises, the rate at which it rises varies. Some cycles, it seems days before I can even notice it getting hotter. Others, the moment I wake up, I feel like I'm in a furnace. The pain I experience is greater than any language ever known to man or God can describe. In between searching for a way to kill myself, I've come across others dealing with their own personal hell. Sinners, I call them. Some I come across early enough in their cycle that they can speak to me, while others are in too much pain to do anything but scream. From talking to other sinners, I've come to learn that there exists only one way out of this place of torment. I come to know this because, as I was sharpening a branch against a rock to stab myself in the chest with, I was approached by a man. He had clearly gone a while without repeating a cycle, as his skin had turned to leather from the heat. Through tears that immediately evaporated once they touched his cheeks, he pleaded with me to shove the branch I was holding down his throat. Refusing to unless he told me why, he explained that he had made a fortune on Earth through lying, stealing millions from elderly people by saying he would invest it and triple their money. He said a man in the maroon suit had told him that the only way he could repeat his cycle was by having someone shove an object down his throat so he could tell no more lies. Feeling sorry for the man, I stood up to oblige his offer. But before I could do so, another female sinner approached us and started beating on the man, claiming that the man had stolen their money and that had forced the woman to resort to thievery, the sin that landed her in hell. In a hysterical movement, the man screamed out and shoved the woman into a nearby river of lava. As the woman fell into the lava, her body let out a flash of light, and she vanished. Immediately after doing this, the man's eyes rolled back into his head, his arms and legs became rigid, and he fell to the ground, screaming so loud my ears started to bleed. So I hurled myself into the river of lava and woke up in a new place in hell. I came across a few others like the man, sinners with eyes rolled back and rigid bodies that were charcoal black from burning, sinners that could do nothing but scream, and in talking to others, looking for ways to restart their cycles, I came to know that others had witnessed events such as the one I had as well. After talking to a demon, what I now called the men in maroon suits, who talked to me in exchange for me killing myself however he chose, it was confirmed to me that there was only one way out of this place. One must find someone they had known on Earth that was involved in their sin and be killed by them. When this happened, the murdered would never again wake to repeat their cycle, having escaped through something akin to death. There was a catch, however. While the murdered were free of this place, the murderer would lose any ability to think, only retaining their ability to feel. Because of this, they would never again be able to restart their cycle, only experiencing an ever-increasing pain for all of eternity. After sharing this knowledge, the demon told me to kill myself by repeatedly smashing my head into a nearby boulder. I obliged, not wanting to know what the demon could do to me otherwise. Years after that day, I came across someone I hoped I would never see again. As I was walking alongside a river of lava, the heat not yet high enough to cause me a great deal of pain, I saw a demon talking in between fits of laughter and a woman on her knees sobbing next to him. Both of them in the same place I had first woken up at. My memory from Earth had all but faded during my years in hell, but something about her seemed familiar, Then I noticed a ring on her finger. It was my Christina. A wave of emotions flooded over me, emotions I had not experienced in years. My fiance, the girl I had loved, was in hell. Before I could cry out to her,
she solemnly nodded her head at the demon and jumped off the cliff they were atop,
plummeting to the ground. When she hit the ground, a loud pop rang out as her neck broke. Her lifeless body lay there for a few seconds before a hole appeared in the ground and swallowed her body. I ran over to the demon, asking who the woman was. Oh, her? Just some broad who killed herself over a lover. I fell to my knees, my mind blank. As I sat there, a thought crept into my mind. Christina was my ticket out of here. If I could trick her into killing me, I would be free of this place. I just had to find her again. Because the heat was starting to become unbearable, I threw myself off the same cliff Christina had. Every time I awoke from restarting the cycle, I searched for Christina. I would search until the pain made every movement an agonizing ordeal, then search some more. The minutes turned into days, and the months turned into years. I found her twice in those years, but each time I was right at the moment of her demise. After all but giving up, I woke up after hanging myself with the entrails of another sinner to find that I was at the base of the same rocky hill I had first awoken on and had first seen Christina on. I turned my head, and 20 feet from me lay Christina. I cried out, thinking that she had just killed herself, and I had failed again. Then she started to move. She raised her head, a look of depression strewn across her face, and looked around to lock eyes with me. Christina's eyes opened wide, astonished. "Josh!" she yelled out as she sprinted towards me. She threw herself into my arms, and we embraced each other. I couldn't believe I had finally found her. I had finally found my Christina. Now that I had, though, my emotions were in ruins. Finding her and tricking her into killing me had just been a dream, a thought to keep me going. But now that she was here, could I go through with it? Could I sentence Christina to a life of unending torture? As these thoughts raced around in my mind, I felt the air around us getting hotter. I realized I had to. Even if it meant her being here forever with no reprieve, I had to trick Christina. I had to save myself. "Josh, I'm so glad to see you. Wait. No. She became frantic as she realized her seeing me meant I was in hell too. "Christina, I love you, but I need you to calm down. I know how to escape this place, and we both can now that we're together, but you need to listen to me. We don't have much time." I told her that the only way we could leave hell was by her pushing me off the cliff on the rocky hill, waiting until I hit the ground and was dead, then immediately jumping and landing in the same spot I did. When she asked why she had to push me instead of me jumping, I made up a story and told her it was because I had died first. Thankfully, she bought it. As we made our way up to the top of the cliff, she explained that she had spiraled into a deep depression after the police told her they had found my body. They told her what had happened and gave her the ring they found in my pocket, the same ring I had given to her when I asked her hand in marriage, and the same ring she gave back to me on the night we broke up. She went through years of therapy, but it was to no avail. 3 years to the day after we broke up and I killed myself, she swallowed a bottle of pills, downed a handle of whiskey, and fell asleep clutching the ring I had given her. She faced me, tears streaming down her cheeks, and said, "I love you, Josh. I never stopped loving you. I..." "Thanks," I said as I turned my face towards the ground. We had finally reached the top of the cliff, the heat starting to rise once again. Christina then embraced me one last time and walked to the edge of the cliff. I followed, looking out over the hellscape. "Are you ready?" Christina asked, motioning for me to stand closer. "Yeah. Yeah, I am." I stood on the edge of the cliff, only my toes keeping me from dropping. Christina stood on the other side of me, turned her head up to face me, gave me a kiss, and put her hands on my chest. Right before she extended her arms, I grabbed her wrists.
"What are you doing?" she said, puzzled.
I stepped behind her, and through tears I told her, "I love you, my Christina." I slid the ring off her finger, and I pushed Christina to her death. As she struck the ground and her body started to disappear in a flash of light, I smiled, and then I waited. I waited for my eyes to roll into the back of my head, for my mind to go blank, full of only suffering, to start experiencing an unimaginable pain that I could not lessen. Yet none of this happened.
"Bravo, my boy," I heard behind me.
I quickly turned my head, finding myself face to face with a demon I knew from years earlier, the tall, thin man in the maroon suit.
"Zave?" I managed to say, still confused.
"Oh my goodness, would you look at that? He even remembered my name," shouted the man, now twirling the cane in his left hand.
What do you want?" I said through chattering teeth, still fully expecting to lose my mind and become one of the lost sinners. Yet as I stood there, I noticed a distinct lack of heat. If anything, the air around me was now chilly, a sensation I had long forgotten.
"Why, my boy, I want to congratulate you. I've been welcoming people for as long as I can remember. Millennia. But you are my first sinner to ever release their cycle."
The man could not contain himself and was now dancing around me.
"What do you..." I said before Zave cut me off.
"Let me explain. All that stuff I said to you in the beginning, a lot of that was a lie."
"Lying in hell?
Devilish, I know. Actually, that was a lie as well.
No, boy, you're not in hell."
The man turned to face me with a grin that sent chills down my spine.
"You thought this was bad? Please, this is a vacation in the Caribbean that just so happens to be a little bit warmer compared to what that place holds." The man shuddered.
This is more of a purgatory where every sinner goes for a chance at redemption.
See, you could have tricked Christina into pushing you off the cliff. You could have been selfish and sentenced her to eternal damnation to save yourself. But you didn't. You chose to sacrifice yourself for her, and in doing so, you broke your cycle. I didn't know what to say. After years of torture, experiencing pain beyond belief, killing myself in ways too numerous to remember, was it all going to finally be over?
"What about Christina?" I found myself saying.
"Christina? Oh, you mean that broad that you pushed off the cliff?
Yeah, she gets a second chance too. See, Christina knew that if she murdered you, she would be stuck here forever."
"My dear boy, you weren't tricking that girl one bit. She knew the rules of the game before you did."
The man in the maroon suit turned away from me and chuckled.
"She knew you were trying to sacrifice her and save yourself, but she went along with it, all so you could escape."
I was dumbfounded. Christina was willing to stay here forever, being tortured every second of every day for all of eternity, for me, even after she thought I was sentencing her to damnation to save myself. I fell to my knees and wept.
"Whoa, now, slow down there, boy. There's no need to cry. You passed the test, and so did she."
The man ran his fingers across his suit with a smug expression on his face. I wiped my eyes and looked at the man, who was now standing inches away from me.
"What now?"
I asked timidly. The man squatted down in front of me, put his hand underneath my chin, lifted my face up and said,
"Now, my dear boy, she gets another chance, and so do you."
With that, the man stood up, stepped back, raised his cane above my head, gave me a wink, and slammed the ruby on the ground. I awoke on that trail overlooking the city, the lights illuminating the clouds above me, and a 9mm pistol sitting in my hand. To make a long story short, Christina and I made things work. After waking up, I immediately drove as fast as I could back to her place, unlocking the door with the key I had forgot to give back to her, rushed inside to find her sitting on the floor crying, knelt down beside her, and held her. She was astonished to see me, But to my surprise, she had no recollection whatsoever of the place we had both previously suffered in. I guess because that maroon-suited demon took time back to before she had killed herself as well. After talking for hours that night, we decided we were going to make this work, whatever the cost. I'm writing this 7 years later from my laptop, sitting in bed next to Christina, now my wife, and our 5-year-old daughter watching Moana on Disney Plus. Things have been great since those days. I now have a house, a well-respected career, a family, a shiny new car, a pool in the backyard, and I'm fully expecting a promotion within the next week. I have everything a man could dream of. I'm happy. I'm happy except for the nights when I wake up drenched in sweat from my bed, having had a nightmare that I was right back in that cursed place, or when I step into a shower that's a tad too hot and start having flashbacks of the years when I would drench myself in lava to restart a cycle, or when I hear somebody in a movie scream and think back to that poor man who is still lying on that brimstone ground crying out for reprieve that is never going to arrive. I escaped, but that doesn't mean you will. Let this serve as a warning to everybody who thinks their actions have no consequences. They do. And please, trust me, you don't want to find out what your own personal hell is going to be. I had made a pretty obvious horror film mistake of moving into a house that everyone said was haunted. In my defense, it was the only place my parents would let me move into. One of the owners had been my babysitter back when I was a kid. The place was called Lion's Grove, and it doesn't seem much like a haunted house. It's a lovely big building on a hill overlooking the beach with a huge garden full of flowers and fruit trees. It's owned by two sisters, Madigan, my old babysitter, and Margaret Blackwood, who was a little younger than me. I didn't see much of Madigan nowadays and communicated mainly with Margaret, a cheerful woman with spiky, green-tipped blonde hair who was in a local punk band called The Clots. The Blackwoods had made their fortune making jam. It came in a glass jar with lion embellishments, with a black lion head on the label that read Blackwood Jam. I was to stay on the first floor, leaving the ground floor alone, because that was Madigan's space, and she didn't like company. I shared the bathroom, little kitchenette, and living area with Margaret, who spent most of her time either performing or working in the garden, so we didn't get in each other's way. The sisters had a good system going, Margaret tending to the fruit trees, Madigan making the jam and jarring it, then Margaret sending it off. It was honestly an awesome place to work. I could stroll down the beach or curl up on the garden bench with a book. Free jam that normally I could never afford, as it was the fancy stuff that cost too much. Margaret had a floor, to wall, to ceiling, bookshelf full of records, books, and VHS tapes of cult horror films that she let me browse. The whole place was old-fashioned, but in a very interesting way. It was all mahogany, Persian carpets, Tiffany lamps, oil paintings, and stained glass windows with arched doorways and huge, sweeping ceilings. Of course, there were lion motifs everywhere. A brass door knocker, all the handles in the house, statues, and in the paintings and carpets. On a day off, I tried to count every lion I could find on the first floor and gardens and gave up because there were just too many. For a young dweeb who had just barely managed to escape the clutches of their overprotective parents, I felt like I'd hit the jackpot. There'd been barely any interest in the room because of Lion's Grove's sordid history. Lion's Grove was the home of the infamous New Year's Day murders. Madigan and Margaret's mother, Elspeth, had murdered the rest of the family. I remember as a kid finding it hard to keep track of the family, because they all tended to have similar-sounding names. Elspeth killed her husband, Madden Lamb, her husband's siblings, Jameson and Georgette Lamb, her niece, Simone, and her own son, Madigan's twin, Jermaine. Afterwards, she'd drowned herself in the sea. Her two daughters had been the only ones spared. Margaret had just been a baby, and Madigan a teenager. Madigan,
who had spent the Christmas period getting drunk downtown with her friends, had walked in on New Year's Day to discover the remains of her family. There were a lot of rumors of exactly how Elspeth had killed them, each more gruesome than the last, but no one knew the truth. The only ghost that haunted the place was Madigan. She worked on cooking and jarring the jam all night, and then slept the whole day away. She was a frail-looking woman with huge, empty eyes and long blonde hair. I barely ever saw her. She had her own bathroom and kitchen down on the ground floor. Sometimes, if I was in the garden, I'd look over and see her sitting in her window seat, just staring off into the distance. Obviously, she'd babysat me before the murders had happened. I remembered she'd been pretty fun, letting me get away with everything my parents would overprotect me from. We'd go to the beach, in the park, watch PG-rated TV shows, and make pancakes. She'd also tell me spooky bedtime stories, which gave me a love of horror even to this day. I cried for days when I learned she would no longer babysit me. One of the bedtime stories, she told me, has become scarier in hindsight. I remember I was tucked under my blankets, hugging my Wags the Dog toy under my chin, watching wide-eyed as Madigan spoke. Her face was different, too, when she told me stories of zombies and witches. There was sadness in her eyes as she smoked a cigarette, blowing the smoke out of my cracked-open window so my parents wouldn't notice the smell. Once upon a time, there was a castle in the mountains that had been ruled by the king and queen for hundreds of years. They were happy and content, and everyone danced in the corridors and sung songs from their windowsills and had plenty to eat and drink. But hidden in the shadowy crevices of the mountains were another jealous family who wanted the castle and all its riches for their own. I watched spellbound as she paused to take another puff of smoke. The family was sneaky. They knew if they attacked the castle, they would be defeated. So they decided to infiltrate it instead. What does infiltrate mean? I asked at once. Said Madigan, blinking at my interruption. It means to get inside somewhere in, like, a sneaky way, like ants crawling inside a crack in the wall. Happy with that explanation, I allowed her to get on with the story. So the cunning family went for the weak spot, the king and queen's daughter. The princess was naive and childish, an only child who longed for a handsome prince to sweep her off her feet. The family sent their oldest child, all dressed in fancy clothes and jewelry, to sing for her underneath her bedroom window. She was charmed by his fake mask and quickly fell in love. I clutched my stuffed animal close to my chest as Madigan stared out the window with a pinched frown on her face. The king and queen did not trust him. They had heard of the family hiding in the shadows of the mountain, but the princess was head over heels in love with the trickster. She snuck out to meet him at night and danced with him under the moonlight, told him all her secrets. He told her lies about the loyal house staff that cooked and cleaned for them, slowly convincing her that they weren't to be trusted. One night she said too much. She told him of a secret entry into the castle, through the basement. I felt the shivers of fright growing stronger in my chest, but Madigan didn't notice that I was shaking under my blankets. She kept on talking. One night, the princess awoke to find her mother and father poisoned in their beds. She immediately suspected the house staff and told the police about her concerns. Outraged at the false accusations, they all quit, leaving the princess alone in the castle. Immediately, the trickster proposed so he could look after her. But when he moved in after their honeymoon, he didn't move in alone. He brought his family with him. Madigan sighed, and I was impressed by how much she was getting into her story, how she looked genuinely upset. She realized too late the mistake she had made, Madigan went on. As soon as they were in the house, the kind and charming mask of the trickster disappeared. Soon he was cruel and demanding, putting the princess to work, doing all the chores in the house. The family took her money and humiliated her at every opportunity.
The castle was no longer full of happiness and light, but filth and darkness.
Madigan's face was a blank, emotionless slate as she came to the end of her story. The princess was overcome with misery and despair at the mistakes she had made. She disappeared into the night, not telling anyone of her whereabouts. They looked up and down for her, finally finding her in the mountains. She had become one with the stone, fused into the rock, the sadness having finally destroyed her. Around the top of her face was a ring of stone, like a crown. She would forever be the queen of the mountain.
Then Madigan flicked the cigarette out the window, told me goodnight, and left. I remembered being a bit let down by the story. It wasn't as gruesome and exciting as other stories she told me. No guts and blood or anything. I quickly forgot about it and went to sleep. It wasn't long after that Madigan stopped coming around. I didn't know then, but this was the last time she'd babysit me before the murders happened. When it was nearing the end of the year, Margaret, who noticed I was pretty antsy when it came to my parents and clearly didn't want to visit them, invited me to share Christmas with her and Madigan. My family had never made a big deal over holidays and didn't mind that I was staying home. Margaret went full hog. She decorated the whole place in wreaths and fairy lights, brought down a white Christmas tree from the attic that was so tall it touched the living room ceiling. She made a gingerbread house and cooked mulled wine, even though we lived in Australia, and it was the middle of summer. She even made me a stocking to go along with hers and Madigan's to hang on the mantle. It threw me for a bit of a spin. Christmas had always been nothing to me. Now she was putting all this effort in? Did that mean I had to get her a thoughtful present? How do you go about getting someone a thoughtful present? I ended up buying a bunch of different flowers and fruit seeds. On Christmas Eve, it had been a scorching day and a muggy evening. I was surprised to find that Madigan had left the ground floor and was sitting on the couch next to Margaret, still looking as shell-shocked as ever. They were watching Christmas movies, one after the other. We were sharing spiked hot chocolate with marshmallows, even though it really wasn't the weather for it. Madigan was drinking the most, on her third cup, when we were still nursing the first. After the credits of Love Actually rolled, she got up out of her seat. She climbed the stepladder for the highest shelf, where two tapes and plain white cases sat. She grabbed one and walked over. Margaret looked uncomfortable, but didn't say anything. Getting a better look at the case, I saw scrawled on the front, Christmas dinner. I immediately wanted to leave, but felt rooted to the couch. No one said anything as Madigan got the tape ready. On the screen was a Persian carpet. I heard muttering as someone fumbled with the camera. In the corner of the screen was the date, 25/12/1994. Then it turned upright, and a woman's face filled the screen. She was downstairs in the dining room where I wasn't allowed. I could hear chattering in the background. The woman had lank blonde hair and was wearing an old-fashioned red velvet dress and a gawping expression, mouth hanging open and eyes boggling behind her glasses. I recognized her from the old news reports and the pictures online. It was Elspeth. "Now you'll understand why," she said, and then wandered out of the frame. A teenager walked in and started setting the table, putting down knives and forks, wine glasses and cups. She was the Madigan of my childhood. Elspeth wandered in, putting down platters of food, mashed potatoes, cauliflower with cheese sauce, tomato and onion pie, ham, beef, turkey and lamb, peas and carrots, and a huge gravy boat. Then she uncorked some bottles of wine and opened up soft drink bottles. As she began to pile food onto plates and pour drinks, footsteps clattered behind her. Her shoulders stiffened, and Madigan looked at her, fear in her eyes. The rest of the family began to trickle inside, taking their seats, still chatting. As the brother-in-law, Jameson Lamb, a big, balding, sweating-looking guy, walked in, I saw him reach over and grope Elspeth's arse like it was the most normal thing to do in the world. His dainty-looking sister, Georgette Lamb, saw and giggled, smacking her brother on the arm. Elspeth's face kept its gawping expression as she put baby Margaret in her high chair. When Georgette sat down, she sent Elspeth a narrow look of loathing. "Have another glass, Germaine," said the patriarch of the family, Madden, to his son. Madden looked a lot like Jameson, except Madden had nicer clothes, was clean-shaven, and was trying to convince the world he wasn't balding with a bad comb-over. Germaine, Madigan's twin, was a blonde kid who looked to me like a cross between Bart Simpson and Beavis. Madigan tried to take a seat on the other side of the table, and there was a loud protesting sound. Her cousin, Simone, petite and dark-haired like her mother, Georgette, sent Madigan a withering look. "What the hell are you doing?" she said loudly. "Are you retarded? That's my seat." All the adults but Elspeth laughed like Simon had just told the wittiest of jokes. Madigan looked like she was swallowing razors as she reluctantly took a seat next to her twin brother. He grinned at her in a wolfish way that made my skin crawl. I wished they'd shut the tape off. I felt nauseated. I didn't dare look at the adult Madigan beside me. "Where are the Christmas crackers?" said Madden. Elspeth immediately leapt to her feet, running off. "God, just when you thought you couldn't get more brain dead," he said after her in a cheerful voice, as Jameson and Georgette burst into laughter. "Can't do anything right, our Elspeth," Madden went on, and then dragged his fork through his food. "Look at this slop, my God. Not much difference to the contents of a toilet bowl." "Oh, she's been working over this all morning, sweating and panting," Jameson said, grinning with nicotine-stained teeth, when Elspeth said nothing. Silently placing the crackers on the table, Madden rolled his eyes. "It's just a joke," he said. "Don't chuck a fit." Simone was playing with her food, flicking peas into her glass of soft drink, smearing her mashed potatoes onto the tablecloth next to her plate. When Elspeth stared at her, she glowered back. "What?" she demanded. Georgette patted her daughter's hand. Simone turned to glare at her mother. "She's freaking staring at me," she said. Then she pushed her plate onto the floor, gravy, meat, and vegetables flying. The adults all laughed again, as though this was great entertainment. "Shouldn't have stared then, eh?" said Madden, as Elspeth silently got to her hands and knees to clean up the mess. Georgette sent her daughter a glance and made the slightest motion at her cup of soft drink. I saw Simone frown in confusion. Georgette mouthed, "Go on." A look of glee crossed the girl's face. Picking up the glass, she slowly poured it over her aunt's back and hair. The whole table, but Madigan, burst into hysterical laughter. Jameson grabbed Elspeth's head and shoved it towards his crotch as Elspeth wrenched away. Baby Margaret had started to cry in her high chair. Germaine knocked over his glass as he jumped to his feet. "I'll take her to bed," he said eagerly, the wine stain spreading across the tablecloth. Elspeth looked up from the floor, an expression of pure panic on her face. "No," she whispered, struggling to her feet. "Are you forgetting the mess you made?" Madden said to her, raising an eyebrow. Germaine was already lifting baby Margaret from the high chair, holding her close to himself. "Please," said Elspeth, reaching out for her daughter. "Goddamn lazy bones over here," Madden exclaimed with a grin, shaking his head. "Unbelievable." "Anyways, shouldn't you be working on dessert, love?" said Jameson, his voice dripping with sleaze. "I'm not sure how it can be any worse than this at dinner," said Madden, even though I'd noticed he'd eaten nearly all of his plate. "But all right, go. And get dessert sorted and clean up later. Germaine, take the baby to bed." His son nearly raced from the room with excitement. Elspeth was frozen in place. The gawping look on her face was back, all staring eyes and hanging mouth. "Are you
deaf? Madden said loudly.
Elspeth slowly drifted from the room like seaweed through water. The puddle of gravy and soft drink was leaking towards Simone's feet.
Ew, it's gross, she screamed. My new shoes! Mom!
We'll just get you more tomorrow, sweetheart, Georgette said soothingly. Your aunt will drive us down to the shops.
Simone was settled by this, falling quiet. Madigan got to her feet and ran from the room. There was a sound of the front door opening and then slamming as she left the house. None of the family noticed.
What do you think, then? Jameson said to his brother. The whole basement is going to waste. We move Elspeth and her jam shit out of there, do it up, it'll be perfect. I tell you, porn's going online. The heyday of dirty magazines is coming to an end. I'll be obsolete in a few years. I need to move to film or I'll be left behind.
I felt a chill go through me. I didn't even realize the house had a basement. I just assumed Madigan made all the jam in jars in her kitchen.
But why do we have to do it in my house? Madden replied, exasperated like they'd had this conversation before. What's wrong with your office in town? You've been taking the damn photos there all these years.
You can't swing a cat in that office, Jameson said. I need space.
And new filming equipment, Madden said with a sigh. I need to stock up on my Mary Kay as well, Georgette cut in.
Madden stared up at the ceiling like he was pleading with God.
You haven't even gotten rid of the last lot yet, he said desperately to his sister. It's spilling out into the hallway.
Georgette tensed up, and she looked over at Jameson. I need my Mary Kay, she said, sounding eerily like her daughter.
All right, said Madden to his siblings. All right, I guess we'll just have to dip into the inheritance money like we always do.
Everyone paused and then looked up suddenly. There was a scream from above them.
Mom! Mom, stop! Mommy!
Then the scream was muffled. Madden's cheerful look disappeared, changing into one of anger. He rose from his seat, then he stopped mid-step at the sound of clattering footsteps on the stairs. Everyone was staring, looking completely baffled, over at a point beyond the camera. There was silence, except for harsh, snuffling breath over where they were looking.
Mom, said Simone, her voice high. What's she doing? She's scaring me.
Is this some kind of joke? Madden snapped.
Have you lost your mind? What the hell do you think you're...
Then they all cowered on the spot, and the camera shook madly before smashing to the ground. There were a few moments of the camera staring at the carpet, as there were panicked screams, running footsteps, crashing glass. Then thumping noises and grunts like someone had fallen down a flight of stairs. Baby Margaret was crying in the distance. When the camera was picked up again, I shrunk back in my seat. Elspeth was standing in her red velvet dress, and a massive lion head made of velvet, wall-eyed, and a disheveled blonde mane. She just stared into the camera for a few moments, and then fumbled to turn it off. Margaret was still crying. The tape ended. The adult Margaret looked at me with an apologetic look on her face. The adult Madigan slowly got to her feet and went over to eject the tape, sliding it back into its case. In the reflection of the television screen, I could see that I had nearly shrunk all the way into the sofa, pale and shaking. I noticed as Madigan returned the tape to the shelf, the second tape in plain white case beside it. Then she silently went to fill up her cup with more spiked hot chocolate. Margaret and I got up to do the same. That night, I couldn't sleep. The image of the lion head staring into the camera, the white case of the second mysterious tape, all of it was flashing in my mind. Sitting up, I felt my head swirl with drink. Maybe if I was sober, I wouldn't have been stupid enough to do what I did next. Moving clumsily through the dark corridor, I used the light from my phone to go into the lounge room. I got the stepladder and reached for the second tape. It had nothing written on the front. Maybe it was blank. but I had a feeling it wasn't. Climbing back down to the floor, I went to the television, and when I turned it on, I quickly put the volume all the way down. You may cringe at this, but I'd never used a VHS player before, Margaret having always put the tapes on whenever I asked. In my defiance, my smothering parents thought I'd electrocute myself using any basic household appliances. I'd only used a toaster for the first time last year. I stared blankly at the buttons, confused over why the tape wouldn't slide in, and finally realized I was pushing it in upside down. It took me about 5 minutes to get it playing. The TV flickered, and then the screen filled up with the crackling image of the blue peaceful sea, the sun shining down on the water. I realized this was the view from the garden over the ocean. The date in the corner of the screen read 27/12/1994. In the background were faint screams. A rowboat swam into the frame. Elspeth was rowing the boat, and she was as naked as the day she was born. The rowboat moved through the water, disappearing from view. There was silence, the film playing for a good few minutes. Then there was a sound of footsteps across the sand that suddenly paused, and then picked up into a frantic run. I saw the back of a blonde head racing into frame, staring wildly to and fro. Then the camera was grabbed and turned off. The tape ran out. I heard something shift behind me, and my insides turned to water. Whipping around, clutching at my heart, and exhaling harshly, I saw Madigan standing in the doorway. She looked more like a ghost than ever, the light from my phone washing her in white light. I'm so sorry, I sputtered out at once. Madigan didn't say anything. She went over, ejected the tape, and put it back in its case. She didn't return it to the bookcase. Silently, she grabbed my arm and pulled me from the room. Without thinking, I let her, even though I was strong enough to pull away. Again, I blamed the booze, but also shame. I felt like a naughty kid being dragged to time out. We walked down the stairs together on the ground floor foyer. I'd never lingered here before, quickly running up to my room every time. Madigan opened up a door that I'd always thought was just a linen cupboard. Stone stairs led downwards into darkness. We went down, my phone lighting the way. The first thing when I saw in the basement made me slam my hand over my mouth to muffle a scream. Hanging from the wall was the velvet dress and massive lion head. Madigan let go of my arm, staring at the costume silently. The basement was stone and concrete, with glass-blowing equipment on one side for the jam jars, the other side of the basement holding an industrial food grinder, no doubt for the fruit. "It's all in here," Madigan said, turning the second tape in her hands. It was the first time I'd heard her speak since I was a kid. "You need to rewind it to the start to watch what happened to them." I was frozen. "Jermaine was still alive when I found him," she said. Strapped to a chair, penis, eyes, tongue, lips, hands cut off, the wounds cauterized. The body parts were all ground up in a jam jar next to him. He didn't last very long. She pointed to a corner of the basement. "Right there," she said. "That's where he was." Then she walked over and opened up a door that led to a space underneath the stairs. "Simone," she lowered her feet first into the grinder. "Georgette and Jameson woke up, locked in this room with a fruit peeler, a plate of meat and the tape of Simone being processed so they knew what the meat was. We found them, arms flayed, wrist to elbow with their own skin in their stomachs. They died of the blood loss. The plate of meat hadn't been touched." She kept on staring, blank-faced into the empty room. "Mom was really angry. Because when she pushed Madden down the stairs, he'd cracked his head open and died in a few minutes. She said she had something really good planned for him, and it had all gone to waste. She did film him spasming on the floor, though, choking on his own blood." I remembered the video we'd watched, hearing the lump of something falling down the stairs. "She put him in the grinder and spread the gore all over the basement floor," said Madigan. In the video, she was whispering, like jam, the whole time she did it.
She turned back to me, looking down at the videotape in her hands.
I managed to make a copy of this before the original was seized by the police, she said, and then raised an eyebrow. Do you really want to watch it?
I slowly shook my head.
Why did you copy it? I asked. Why do you keep it?
Madigan just shrugged.
I like watching them die, she replied. I was wrong, though. She didn't become Queen of the Mountain. She became Queen of the Sea. I never thought she'd have the guts to bring the whole bastard lot of them with her. I'm glad.
I slowly realized, like the drunken idiot I was, the situation I was in. Why had she taken me down here? Was she about to follow in her mother's footsteps and violently murder me for prying into her family history? Madigan was looking at me with a strange look in her eye.
I used to call you Sticky Beak, she said. You'd always get into my bag and dump my cigarettes and tampons all over the floor. I don't know how many times I caught you with your hand in the biscuit jar.
I realized what the look in her eye was. It was fondness. Madigan didn't put the lion head on and push me into the grinder. She just stared at her mother's bizarre costume for a few more moments, and then opened up the door, wandering up the stairs. I raced to follow her, not wanting to be left here in the basement alone. I watched as Madigan went down the corridor into her room, still carrying the tape. She shut the door behind her, not saying another word. I just stood, slack-jawed and dazed, not knowing what the hell to do. Why had she told me? Was it a warning? Behave yourself or you're next? It was only when I was in bed that I remembered the film. The reports always said Madigan had been boozing around town with her friends until she came back home on New Year's Day. But the tape? The tape said she'd come back on the 27th. And what about Margaret? That's when I realized all at once, the cold ice running through me. Madigan had taken care of her baby sister, ignoring the screams down in the basement until they were gone. Then on New Year's, she'd rung the police to report them dead. Why hadn't the authorities noticed this gap in time? Why hadn't her friends reported it? Madigan had copied the tape, maybe the footage the police had gotten, had that final sea voyage cut out. Her friends, maybe they were all just too wasted to remember the particular dates. The next day, Margaret woke me early, even though I really hadn't managed to sleep. She'd gotten Madigan out of her room, and we had buttermilk pancakes for breakfast. The whole time, Madigan stared at me out of the corner of her eye. Then we emptied our stockings. Margaret laughed with delight at the present I'd gotten her and gave me a hug.
Sorry. I didn't know what to get you, I muttered sheepishly to Madigan.
But she was looking over at Margaret, face lit up with joy, a slight smile on her face.
You didn't have to get anything for Margaret, she said. You're a good kid.
I could only manage a weak nod as I watched her smear her second helping of pancakes, thick with raspberry jam.